You've got enough on your plate. Mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cook Unity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cook Unity, affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code podcast before checkout for 50% off your first week.
Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, often when we observe animals in their natural environment, we will see that they're working in a group or a collective. But take one of that group and put it in another colony, pack, or tribe of the same species, and things get ugly pretty fast. In the animal kingdom, strangers are danger. But how come we're so tolerant? How did we build a society where strangers feel safe among us and we among them? Mark Moffat is a research biologist at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian and author of The Human Swarm: How Our Societies Arise, Thrive and Fall. He joins me now. Mark, welcome to the program. I suppose if we have to talk about human society and how we've developed to be the way we are, we must start with the lowly ant.
Well, turns out you can learn a few things from the lowly ant, Jonathan, and they aren't as smart as us, but they have certain elements to the way they operate that have similarities to humans that are very helpful in understanding how we evolved.
Talk to us about this idea of strangers in groups across various species. Was I right in what I was saying, that mostly in if you have two different colonies, if you get a stranger from one species in another, they're usually attacked? Is that typical in the animal kingdom?
That's typical for most vertebrate animals. You know, most of the species we think of, like lions and wild dogs and other things like that. The ants are different, though. A chimpanzee, I like to say, would not be able to handle what really is the most remarkable thing for humans, and that is a Starbucks. I think you have Starbucks in Ireland, don't you?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Walking into a Starbucks is the most incredible thing humans do, because we can go through that crowd of people sitting with their coffees and not want to kill them or run away in fear. Now, a chimpanzee couldn't handle that. A chimpanzee needs to know everyone in the room. And what ants and humans have done is gotten around that in their own way, but pretty much for this using the same strategy. And that is, we don't need to know individuals to be comfortable in that Starbucks or wherever we are. We just need to feel that they belong. And that happens because we sense some commonalities with us. In the case of ants, they have a national flag imprinted on their body surface, which is an odor, a scent. And as long as all the ants around a particular ant has that scent, they're golden. There's no fighting that goes on. They are identified as members of the same society. And because of that, ants can have societies, as you well know from visiting your kitchen some days, that can extend into very large populations, sometimes even in the millions. A chimpanzee society is only a few dozen individuals. They have to remember everyone. It takes too much cognitive energy for them to have large societies.
Isn't the way these animals breed also a limiting factor? The way ants and chimpanzees are produced are very different. You can't really build that big a colony and know them all if you're a chimpanzee.
Well, no, over time you could, and humans have done that as well, of course. Over time, we started off with hunter-gatherer groups of upwards to maybe a couple thousand individuals spread out over space. And even back then, 10, 20,000 years ago or more, we didn't necessarily know all those individuals. Some of them lived at the far end of the territory. We might have heard about them. We may not have seen them in years, but we could still recognize that they belong through all kinds of traits that they have in common with us. And I like to talk, I have a book, The Human Swarm, on this, and I talk about us having being walking billboards for our identities. We don't just have that national flag scent. We don't have that. Probably, possibly we have a scent difference. It's hard to say, but we certainly have all kinds of other features, some of them obvious and some of them not, including things like flags, all the way down to how we walk and talk and other traits. So we can actually tell who belongs, and psychologists have shown that we do that very fast. A fraction of a second, we identify the categories of the different people around us.
I used to work in Ibiza on the streets, and one of my jobs was trying to hawk poor passersby into the bar to buy our overpriced and watered-down drinks. And one of the things that we were able to do from quite a distance, and I remember it still, is we'd be able to identify the nationality of a family a good half a kilometer to a kilometer away. We'd see the way they walked, how they behaved with their children, how upright they were, and their gait and how they talked, how they gestured with each other. And we could immediately tell that's a German family. We have to beim ersten Getränk gibt es eine freie Tequila oder Schnaps. We go into your German line, or then you have the Spanish line ready. You could, you know, affect a more Irish accent to attract the Americans and so on. All these little tricks that we had, but we could recognize people very, very quickly.
Yeah, no, that's something that's been studied by Abigail Marsh at Georgetown University. Some of these subtleties, we don't even know we have this skill. The skill you talked about, apparently you knew you had, but most people don't realize it. And she made a study of Americans and asked them if they could guess if the person walking at a distance was an American, and they almost always got it right. They didn't know they could do that. She also did studies showing the face of a Japanese ancestored person with a neutral expression, and those people couldn't tell, looking at that face, what nationality the person was. But if the person smiled, they could guess that they were American. So we all smile around the world, but apparently there are subtle differences from nation to nation in the way we use our muscles to smile.
Wow.
So these traits are everywhere, and we're not conscious of many of them. And we like to think we're neutral about other people, but our brains are processing them very fast and putting people in the categories, including nationalities, which are the modern version of societies, or the greatly expanded version of those hunter-gatherer societies. And the reason they were able to expand is in large part because we have this capacity to be around so many strangers, something that a chimpanzee could never do. So no matter how much a chimpanzee bred generation by generation, its societies will stay a few dozen individuals, because when they get big enough, those societies are full of individuals that don't know each other well, and they will split apart, which is what Jane Goodall discovered years ago to her dismay when her group of chimpanzees split in half and friends started killing each other. So this process of societies forming and eventually breaking apart because of problems like that is, of course, central to a lot of the issues that are going on today, for example.
No, you're right. And group identity has been at the core of every conflict. You look back through history and people might, throw religion off the cliff because of, you know, that being the reason for a conflict. But actually, usually it's down to identity. It's the same in the North. It was the same in the Irish Civil War when brother fought against brother. Same in Rwanda. A sense of I am this person, I'm with this group, and you're with that group. Can often be the difference between friend or foe.
Indeed, and even so, it's even more important than the difference in friend and foe, because, you know, probably your worst enemy is someone living in Ireland. So you can have your best friends and worst enemies within the same society, but, you know, whether you like them or not, they have that Irish passport, they have that Irish characteristic that you identify. So, no, that's a fortunate thing for people, is that we can become friends with the outsider. And it's a trickier deal, because friendships within the group save a lot of mental energy to deal with. But we have, throughout history, formed friendships with outsiders, married outsiders, and so forth. Something that a chimpanzee can't do. Now, the related bonobo, you know the bonobo?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the sexy ape. They tend to be friendly with everybody, but they still have set societies, despite the fact that they don't detest the enemy. They have territories with a society in them. But every once in a while, the bonobos from one group, and this is in the Congo, cross the territory of another group, and they all play around for the day and have a good time. But at the end of the day, they go back to their societies, their separate territories. So this capacity to have both friends and enemies between groups and within groups makes human societies very interesting and complicated. And of course, our social lives as well, very interesting and complicated.
Absolutely. Is there an overarching society then now, if we think about, you know, you talked about nationalities in different groups. Do we have just one society now, a global society? Because you can go anywhere in the world pretty much and not be attacked as a stranger, even if you look very, very different from somebody else.
Well, when we enter that Starbucks, we can pass by people of other nationalities and we can be very comfortable with those nationalities. We've come to know, for example, in America, the Irish and other groups. And so that doesn't mean we attack outsiders. I argue in the book, this idea is cosmopolitanism, the idea of like a umbrella society over the whole world. And I mean, it's a nice notion, but in fact is that we don't want to give our groups. We don't want to give up our groups. They give us meaning and validation. So all these kinds of groups are going to maintain their presence in the world and have territories and so forth into the future. Our timeless yearnings have to do with those. And so both the good and the bad of humanity revolves around these groups. The meaning we get from our lives depends in part, arguably, on the presence of these other groups. So there was an island called Futuna that had two chieftains. And chiefdoms, before the Europeans came along, there were two of these chieftains. And chieftains normally fight with each other and conquer each other. But those chieftains were around apparently for a long, long time, and one of them didn't conquer the other. And I argue in the book that, well, they needed an outgroup. Once you conquered the other ones, who do you have to compare yourself to? So the good and bad of those comparisons, of course, is the source of our troubles. But we need those outgroups. And, you know, no nationality is going to give up its territory for the greater good of all of humanity.
Is there evidence that that we don't allow foreigners in very easily? I mean, certainly anecdotally, every Irish person working in the UK in the 70s and 80s and beyond was called Paddy. And that, that often lighthearted joking was still a marker that you are not one of us. And still, certainly in Ireland, no matter how long someone might live with us, in amongst us, we'll always jokingly report that they're an insider and an outsider. And that makes it very hard for someone to feel as not a foreigner when they join a different group, right? Is there evidence to suggest that we really don't want to get rid of these boundaries?
Well, psychologically, yes. I mean, even infants a few months old, before they're taught about other groups, other ethnicities, are already recognizing people of the ethnicity of their caretaker and responding more positively to them. And so this cognitive bias in our heads is the same skill we use to tell a chair from a table. We put things into categories and we have all kinds of special conditions about we expect from each of those things. And that happens to humans too. And even if we all crossbred forever, our brains would still find ways of splitting us into groups. It's just part of how we deal with the world.
The 1980s had this weird period of moral panic called stranger danger, where as a result of one or two, maybe a handful of isolated, horrible child abductions, the entire media scene went crazy. And also how we spoke to kids about strangers and people from different groups completely changed. The idea that a child should speak to an adult that they didn't know was now seen as a very dangerous thing to do. Parents were terrified of doing this. And you may remember that there's lots of public service announcement campaigns in America around this. Yet, I was listening to a podcast on this recently, the chances of your child actually being abducted by a stranger was less than a millionth of a percent. And yet it was such a present and felt danger in America. And we did something similar here in Ireland, you know, the idea of not speaking to stranger, and it still filters through maybe a watered down version of it. But I'm wondering where that fits in our group mindset. If we're telling people that strangers are dangerous, are we going backwards in our evolution of accepting strangers? And what do you think that sort of psychology does to cultures? Because certainly we seem less tolerant of each other now than we did maybe 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, there are about 10 different avenues I could take with that really interesting question. But, you know, we're always a bit cautious about strangers, even with in our own group. And the part of what you're talking about with stranger danger has to do with strangers across groups, though, a feeling of fear about an ethnic or racial group. And some of that tends to be there. Even in the most enlightened people, there are reactions that we have that you can study that show that people have do tend to associate, in the U.S. at least, blacks with guns, and even if you don't think you do. Mm. But all these things trace back to deep history. I mean, in the deep past, we were small hunter-gatherer groups, and we didn't really know who the groups were that lived over the mountain or whatever. We might have heard about them. And so it was certainly safest to process them in our brains as something that could be a threat. And this sensitivity to the outside world is made us safe back then. Now we know a lot more. But it hasn't particularly helped us.
I guess what I'm asking is, have we been priming society to fear the stranger when actually our ability to embrace the stranger is what enabled such amazing societies, such collaboration, everything from, co-ops to local governments to the European Commission?
Well, it's an interesting question that I can bring back to the animal comparison. One thing about humans that's fascinating is that we have these ethnic and racial groups in our society, but we didn't always. Hunter-gatherers didn't have anything like that. They lived in small groups that were pretty uniform, and no animal does that. And how did that come about? It came about through conquest and sometimes slavery. The original groups within societies built up as societies expanded and took over adjacent groups. A chimpanzee would wipe out an adjacent group. They'd never let individuals in unless she was a sexy female and she has some chance. But those ethnicities and races arose that way. And today you have groups like the Han in China, which looks like a very uniform group, and you're very unified. But if you trace them back in history, there were thousands of different conquests that eventually led to the Han today. So over time, those groups can meld together, but they continue to contrast themselves with other groups. So in the China, there are ethnic minorities that are sort of the source of people's identity by contrast, by comparison. That's been studied quite a lot. And in America, we have our contrast between the different groups here. And some of those contrasts are good because an ethnic group like the Latino community wants to have their own identity, but they also have to belong to the society. And that's the tricky part that humans do that animals can't, is they can be both alike and different. They can be alike enough to be accepted as fellow members, citizens, but different enough to have an identity within the society, both for their own sense of well-being, but also for the well-being and sense of pride for the other ethnicities, including the dominant people, who don't want ethnicities to become too much like them. So there's this power play between all these different things going on in human societies, which is a great part of the book I mentioned, The Human Swarm, that differs from anything, you know, remotely like anything in any other animal. And yet you can trace back the elements through time to what early humans might have done and how we got that way.
Are there any studies that show us a way to increase tolerance of strangers or learn to think of perhaps immigrants or people from other countries as more more friendly, something to be tolerated, celebrated, and so on?
Well, this loops back to an earlier question, and that is the idea of immigrants, foreigners being accepted. And in fact, this is a relatively recent idea, this immigration thing. As I said, early humans, up to really pretty recent times, brought in outsiders through conquest. Mm. The idea that you could bring in large numbers of outsiders and accept them into a society is not an ancient one, and it's always a tricky one. And the problem is the conquest method of doing it assured that the dominant people, say in our societies, white people, had most of the power, prestige, and so on. And the acceptability of the other people depended on them being below that in stature. And immigrants face the same problem today. If you're immigrant coming to the society, there's the sense that you should have a low, we may not verbalize it, but mentally, there's a sense they should have a lower status, not take our jobs, all these kinds of things. Mm. And so immigrants become most acceptable when there's not a lot of social stress. During times of war, when we needed soldiers, immigrants and even ethnic groups within our society, like the Blacks, had the highest status because they could serve as soldiers. Blacks have always had the highest status in America during times of war. These status differences continue today with immigrants. And so the way out of that, of course, is not to have social stress, but social stress comes and goes. And once you have social stress, even the Romans, who were famous for letting in outsiders to live in Rome as become fellow Romans, in times of social stress, they would throw them out of Rome. If there was not enough food, other groups were the first to go.
Got the problems still sticking around since the times of the Romans. It's a really interesting book. And as I say, it brings in comparisons with chimpanzees and examines ants and how humans have developed societies in a similar way. It's called The Human Swarm, How Our Societies Arise, Thrive, and Fall. It's written by Mark Moffat. Mark, thanks for your time.
Hey, Jonathan, this has been great.